result of which is a violation of the human rights of different nations and a gross violation of human rights in general.
Yes, we hope so. Thank you both for being with me, Dr. Mehdi and Dr. Hamid Fakhrizadeh. I appreciate you being with me.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back with more of the program. And thank you, viewers, for staying with us. Don't go away. There's more to the show. Stay tuned.
Now, some may ask, with so much pressure on Iran to stop its peaceful nuclear program, with all these sanctions and the sabotage of Iran's nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iran scientists and more, why doesn't the Islamic Republic just give up on its nuclear program? So let's go over a few reasons. Now, one of the major uses of nuclear energy is in the production of electricity. France, for instance, gets 70% of its electricity from nuclear energy. Now, for Iran, a country with a dry climate, using nuclear energy instead of hydropower plants is ideal, and it's dedicated at least 5 nuclear power plants to the production of electricity. This technology has many uses in the agricultural industry, from genetic modification to pest control using sterilization to water usage control and much more. Now, these are just some of the reasons that the Islamic Republic insists on making use of nuclear technology like other countries, and it has the right to do so. But it's not really about nuclear energy. Over the years, many sanctions have been placed on various other types of technology in Iran as well. The main goal is to keep the Islamic Republic of Iran from progressing, a goal that has clearly failed.
Fakhrizadeh, the Iranian nuclear physicist, vaccine developer, university professor, and more, is no longer amongst us. Now he's reached his dreams of martyrdom while fulfilling what he deemed the holy mission of working to advance his country and serving his people, the dream of giving everything he had for the worthiest cause he knew. Now, today, the same criminal entity that took the life of Fakhrizadeh continues to commit a genocide in Palestine. The same entity that accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of reaching for nuclear bombs has dropped over 40,000 tons of explosives on the Gaza Strip alone, breaking the record of American nuclear bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in death and destruction. But just as the mass murder of Palestinians has not stopped their resistance against Israeli occupation, the assassination of Iranian scientists has only made Iranians more determined to advance their country through their peaceful nuclear program. Well, Iran has certainly lost a few heroes, but the Israeli regime has lost face to millions of people who are taking to the streets to denounce its crimes across the world. And it's just as Imam Khomeini, the late leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, had said, "Go ahead and murder us. It will only awaken the masses."
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The European Union Environment Agency is saying countries across Europe should be prepared for catastrophic risks, ranging from floods to deadly heat waves, as worsening climate change hits every part of their economies and societies. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The European Environment Agency, the EEA, has said in its first risk assessment, Europe is not prepared for the rapidly growing climate risk that it faces. From wildfires burning down homes to violent weather straining public finances, the report says more action is needed to address half of the 36 significant climate risks with potentially severe consequences that it identifies for Europe. The report says five more risks need urgent attention. Lena Ilamononen, the EEA's executive director, said, "Our new analysis shows that Europe faces urgent climate risks that are growing faster than our societal preparedness." The report looks at how severe the climate threats are and how Europe is to deal with them. It says the most pressing risks, which are growing worse as fossil fuel pollution heats the planet, are heat stress, flash floods and river floods, the health of coastal and marine ecosystems, and the need for solidarity funds to recover from disasters. When the researchers reassessed six of the risks for southern Europe, which they described as a hotspot region, they found urgent action was also needed to keep crops safe and to protect people, buildings and nature from wildfires. Robert Biesbroek, a report author from Wageningen University in the Netherlands, who also co-led the chapter on Europe in the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report on adaptation, said, "There is increasing evidence of adaptation, but it's certainly not enough." Robert Biesbroek said, "It's not going quickly enough and it's not reaching the ones that need it most. It's quite scary in that sense." The report also warns of cascading and compounding risks, which it says current stress tests in the financial sector are likely to underestimate. For instance, hot weather will dry out southern Europe, killing crops and shrinking water supplies, but will also harden soils, making flash floods more likely and dry out vegetation, meaning wildfires can spread faster in southern Europe. Governments trying to respond to several crises will be more stretched for resources, as will communities that fail to prepare. Blaz Koenig, the head of the European Environment Agency's Impacts and Adaptation Group, said, "The risks are simply outpacing the developments of policies." Europe has heated up more than any other continent since the Industrial Revolution. It has heated about twice as fast as the global average, as carbon dioxide has clogged the atmosphere and trapped sunlight. The researchers looked at two possible scenarios of low and high warming over the century. They did not consider potential tipping points in the climate system, arguing that the effects of such dramatic changes would unfold over longer time periods, and so did not change the urgency of action in the short term. Daniela Schmidt of Bristol University, who sat on the advisory board of the report but was not involved in writing of the report, said the geographical granularity that the report offered was important, but questioned whether another report on risk was needed. She said, "Will it increase the action? Will it make people more ready to have more information about what those key risks for us are looking like?" Daniela Schmidt, who also co-led the chapter on Europe for their Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report on adaptation said people should understand that governments, cities, and individuals had agency to reduce risks, and that actions to do so would come with benefits such as cleaner air and better housing. She said, "How can we facilitate that people know they have the power to do something?" The European Commission said it would present a communication on managing climate risk recently. The European Environment Agency report says several climate risks have already reached critical levels. It says if decisive action is not taken now, most climate risks could reach critical or catastrophic levels by the end of this century. Leena Ilamanonen said this should be the final wake-up call. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. The European Union Environment Agency said on Monday, 11th of March, countries across Europe should prepare for catastrophic risks ranging from floods to deadly heat waves as worsening climate change hits every part of their economies and societies. The Copenhagen-based body said in its first Europe-wide analysis of climate-related risks, policymakers need to draw up new plans to address the challenges ahead. The European Environment Agency said Europe is the world's fastest warming continent, heating up at twice the global average. Even if countries manage to slow global warming, global temperatures are already more than 1 degree Celsius higher than pre-industrial times. The European Environment Agency said the damage will depend in part on whether policymakers act now to prepare societies, for example, by improving insurance coverage, redesigning infrastructure, and introducing laws to protect outdoor workers from deadly heat. Without more urgent action, the European Environment Agency said most of the 36 climate risks facing Europe could hit critical or catastrophic levels this century. They include risks to health, crop production, and infrastructure. In a pessimistic scenario, by the end of the century, the European Environment Agency said hundreds of thousands of people would die from heat waves, and economic losses from coastal floods alone could exceed 1 trillion euros per year. That would far exceed the 650 billion euros lost to weather and climate-related extremes across the European bloc from 1980 to 2022. Kate Levick, Associate Director of climate think tank E3G, urged governments to respond to the European Environment Agency's findings. Kate Levick said, "There's a particular role for finance ministers to essentially look at what happens to balance sheets in terms of assets and liabilities at national level as a result of climate risk." The European Commission will publish its response to the report in the coming days. According to a draft European Commission communication seen by Bloomberg News Agency, Europe stands to suffer significant economic effects amounting to some 7% of its output by the end of the century, even if the world manages to contain the increase of global temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The European Environment Agency's report argues that climate change will be even more acute in southern Europe, including Greece, with the average temperature in the continent rising by a considerable 3 degrees Celsius in the scenario of a global rise by 1.5 degrees Celsius. The blueprint further warns that in case global warming exceeds 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, the impact will be even more dramatic, with the European Union economy standing to lose some 2.4 trillion euros from its gross domestic product between 2031 and 2050.
On June 18, 1994, when Francisco Oscar Lamolina, the referee of the opening game of the World Cup, blew into the whistle, over 77,000 spectators were shouting in jeers at Pontiac Silverdome Stadium in Detroit. It was the first time that the World Cup was being held in the U.S. For a month, all eyes all over the world were fixated at the event. The shining stars of the world of football, like Romario, Roberto Baggio, Hristo Stoichkov, and Gheorghe Hagi, filled the stadiums to the brim. With every goal, yellow or red cards, the stadiums were in uproar, like the day when Nigeria thrashed Bulgaria with 3 goals and the fans of the team were madly shouting out of joy. People who had traveled thousands of miles from Africa so they could watch the games up close. Those days were good days for the people in Africa, but not for all the residents of the continent. Right at the time when people across the world were glued to their television sets to watch Nigeria's exhilarating display of skills, in a part of Africa, one of the most brutal genocide in the history of mankind was underway. The Tutsi and Hutu tribes in Rwanda were up in arms against each other. In 100 days, 1 million people, nearly 20% of the population of the country, were killed. The Hutus that had control over the government killed so many people from ethnic Tutsis that the tribe lost 75% of its population. The genocide eventually stopped after the UN intervention, but it proved that death in Africa is an ordinary thing that can take place. However, the genocide in Rwanda wasn't the largest massacre Africa was witnessing. In the 60s, amid the French occupation of Algeria, over 1.5 million people died in the country within a span of 2 years only for asking for independence. If you think it was the bloodiest incident in Africa, you'd better go through the history of Belgium, a small country that perks in Western Europe and is shown in a light of democracy and freedom these days. But in the not-too-distant past, it experienced one of the most horrifying governments in history. Leopold II, the former Belgian king, who ruled over the country from 1865 to 1909, occupied the Congo in Africa. During the 44 years of occupation, he slaughtered over 10 million people in the Central African country. Yet, despite the high number of killing, Leopold II is not on top of the list of the biggest murderers in history. As it was announced in the 60s and 70s, the biggest and scariest murder in Africa, unlike what the majority of the people in the world imagine, was a woman. The number of the people this woman put to death is higher than the number of the people killed by Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, and even Genghis Khan put together. Even higher than the number of the people who were killed during the bombing of Dresden in Germany and the victims of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear bombing. Apparently, Rachel Carson is the biggest murderer in history, and yet nobody was aware for a long time. Everyone admired Carson for being a nice human being and a great author, and also for her role as an environmental activist. She has been praised in numerous books, articles, and reports, but in the end, the mask was removed from her face. They said that the woman who had a charming smile on her face in all of the pictures and the only thing she cared about was nature was behind the death of millions of people in Africa. The deaths happened after she genetically modified mosquitoes. If we take a look at history, we'll find out that Rachel Carson's life in many ways had striking similarity with major criminals throughout history, like Hitler, who used to paint pictures when he was a young man, or Stalin, who was a choir singer. Carson was into art, literature, and poetry. She was born in Pennsylvania and graduated from Johns Hopkins University in 1932. After getting a degree in zoology, she started her career as a journalist. 15 years later, she displayed so much talent and skills in the field of aquatic creatures that she supervised all publications in this field. During those years, she tried books besides working as a journalist. Her books are on environment and the seas, which gained Carson fame. She resigned from all of her posts in 1952, so she could concentrate mainly on writing books. The most important book she wrote in that period was her autobiography. The US media, as well as many chemists and physicians, say the book changed the fate of millions of people in African and many other parts of the world. Carson's name turned into the nightmare of people who were grappling with malaria.
In Africa and Asia, the mosquito is a mass killer. More than 2 million people die every year from malaria, which mosquitoes transmit.
In 1962, Carson's Silent Spring was published. In her book, she has talked about the detrimental health hazards on pesticides on food and agricultural products, and that the widespread use of DDT helps the poisonous substance permeate into plants and remain in their texture for a long time and cause disease. They say the publication of the book and raising such issues banned the use of DDT across the world, including in Africa. But the ban in Africa led to the emergence of an old disease across the continent. Back then, many chemists criticized Carson for her theory and claimed it was basically unfounded.
In Miss Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, are gross distortions of the actual facts, completely unsupported by scientific experimental evidence and general practical experience in the field. A suggestion that pesticides are in fact biocides destroying all life is obviously absurd in the light of the fact that without selective biological activity, these compounds would be completely useless.
Based on figures and documents proposed by Dr. Gordon Edwards, an entomologist at the University of San Jose in California, stated in his paper that the elimination of DDT helped the mosquitoes that transit malaria to reproduce without any barriers. In a few years, the population of the mosquitoes grew so large that millions of Africans fell victim to the disease and lost their lives, according to Edwards in an article titled Bias, Misinformation, Half-Truth, published in 1992 in the Science and Technology magazine. The Silent Spring has been one of the deadliest books in history as it sent millions of people in Africa to their death. Some people put the number of fatalities at about 50 million people, larger than the number of the casualties in the Second World War. DDT was first synthesized in 1874 by Othmar Zeidler, but insecticidal properties were not identified until World War II. But from 1939, it was widely used by soldiers on farms to fight off lice and typhus. Major chemical companies produced millions of tons of DDT every year and earned whopping amounts of profits. So it was only natural that the companies were outraged over the ban imposed on production and sales of DDT. Therefore, when Rachel Carson published her book, they spent about $250,000 to debunk her claims.
Measures which research laboriously has developed.
In the media, they called her a radical, hysterical spinster who only keeps cats and hates genetics. It was at that time when Carson was introduced as the biggest criminal in history who caused the deaths of millions of people. Even today, the claim continues to be circulated by some people, but the reality is Rachel Carson was never a criminal or murderer. In fact, the ban on consumption of DDT has nothing to do with her. In fact, 5 years before Carson's Silent Spring was published, the United States Environmental Protection Agency reached the conclusion that using DDT has detrimental effects on humans' health.
A government-backed scientific panel today reported that pesticides may indeed represent a grave threat to mankind.
The average American already has more DDT in his body than is permitted in the meat and fish that we eat. It does not go away, it accumulates, and it passes to babies through their mother's milk.
So the consumption of chemical substance sharply declined from 1957 to 1967, and in 1979, it was completely banned. At that time, it was revealed that DDT is not effective in killing malaria because they quickly adapt themselves to the insecticides. In fact, now everyone knows that Carson and malaria are irrelevant. But powerful businesses and political lobbies in the 60s and 70s grilled the scientists for her studies, and many people detested her. It has happened many times through history. Rachel Carson is only one example of politicizing science.
We have heard a great deal about their safety, but very little about the hazards, very little about the failures, the inefficiencies. And yet the public was being asked to accept these chemicals, was being asked to acquiesce in their use, and did not have the whole picture. So I set about to remedy the balance there.
In 1898, German medical student Hermann Rottmann announced that tobacco causes infection and tumor in the lungs. Laborers at tobacco fields were exposed to the highest risk. He continued to hold to the wrong belief until 1912, when some doctors tied lung diseases to smoking cigarettes. In the 1920s, when lung cancer was being identified, it was attributed to various agents like asphalt and the effects of poisonous gases in World War I. Smoking cigarettes did not have an outstanding place on the list. But in 1939, Hermann Müller in the Cologne University in Germany studied 86 patients with lung cancer and publicly announced the relationship between smoking and the disease. The idea was soon approved by the scientists in the US and Britain, as well as the American Cancer Society. The news was a massive shock to the tobacco industry all over the world, and their shares at the stock markets plunged. Six major cigarette-producing companies decided to find a way out of the crisis. On December 14, 1953, the directors of the companies gathered in the Hotel Plaza in Manhattan and told the reporters that the alleged link between smoking and lung cancer needs further scientific research. They announced that the claim that cigarette is a carcinogen is unfounded, and there are no scientific proof to back the claim. Those who stood up against tobacco companies would face harsh reactions from the companies and the scientists affiliated with the companies.
Four packs of cigarettes a day. I am 55. Yeah! You, wait a second. Tell me if I don't look 20 years younger than this.
These people were on many radio and television shows. Their message to the audience was, "We're not sure if smoking cigarettes can cause cancer." In fact, the doubt ruled the minds of the people. This is known as the trade of doubt.
This is America today. The pace fast, the competition great. We live with more tension, more emotion, more concern about our health, more everything than ever before.
In 1979, a promotional video footage named "Smoking and Health, The Need to Know" was made and broadcast by tobacco companies. The video was played for hundreds of thousands of Americans. During the screening time and after that, the audience was posed with some questions. They were asked, "Is it likely that the concerns raised over smoking and the health hazards are wrong?" A year after the survey, they achieved unbelievable results. There was a 17% decline in the number of those who already believed that smoking can cause cancer. It nosedived to 59% from 76%. The survey was conducted in other countries like Britain and the Netherlands. In the 1980s, Philip Morris spent millions of dollars to persuade the people in the UK that they should not worry about secondhand smoking. Meanwhile, a study conducted in the Netherlands in 2011 showed that 61% of the people in the country believe that smoking poses no threats to non-smokers, while throughout these years, many doctors and scientists have tried to prove to the people that smoking, cigarettes and nicotine can be very hazardous and can lead to many diseases like lung cancer. They published different kinds of figures to push back those who capitalize on doubt. But those who were on the other side of the story, namely tobacco factories and their affiliated scientists, wielded huge power. Now it has come to light that the scientists knew for decades that cigarettes and its compounds are very hazardous for human body. The documents leaked in the 1980s and 1990s by some tobacco company staff revealed that the owners of the companies had known as an established fact from the 1950s that smoking can cause cancer. In one of these documents dated 1953, Claude Thigault, one of the scientific advisors of Camel Tobacco Company, wrote to his director that the tobacco in cigarettes is one of the main factors behind lung cancer, and added that there is a direct correlation between smoking and lung cancer. A decade before that, Emil Harris Palmer, the head of the research center of Lord Yard, acknowledged that there is ample evidence to prove the link between smoking and lung cancer.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Leaders' meeting with families of martyrs and first-time voters. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with a number of first-time voters and families of martyrs just before parliamentary elections were held in Iran. The meeting took place at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in Tehran on Wednesday, 28th of February. In this program, we discuss the leader's remarks and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with a number of first-time voters and families of martyrs on Wednesday, 28th of February. After welcoming the young people, first-time voters and the honourable families of the martyrs, the leader referred to the blessed days of Sha'ban and following that, the blessed month of Ramadan, and urged young people to get closer to the Almighty through prayers and supplication. Ayatollah Khamenei added, Sha'ban is the month of supplications, talking with God and seeking forgiveness. In the few days that are left, my earnest advice to you is to supplicate, seek forgiveness from God and send salutations upon Prophet Muhammad and his progeny, blessings of God upon them. Supplications increase your connection with the Almighty. They strengthen your relationship with Almighty God. When we say, Astaghfirullah wa atubu alayh, I seek forgiveness from God and return towards Him, means that I return towards God. I had distanced myself from God because of my mistakes and sins, and now I'm returning towards the Almighty, and the Almighty accepts this return. When we send our greetings and salutations to Prophet Muhammad and the progeny of Muhammad, peace be upon them, we are in fact reviving the memory of the best human models in our minds. These honourable people are the best human beings and the best individuals that God has created. Their lives, their words and behaviour serve as examples to us all to follow. In Imam Hussein's supplication on the day of Arafah and the supplications of Sahifat al-Sajjadiyya and Munajat al-Sha'baniyya, there are concepts and teachings that one cannot find anywhere else. Developing a companionship with supplications raises the knowledge of a Muslim, and it is very valuable. Turning to parliamentary elections and its importance, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Signs of excitement and enthusiasm for the elections can be seen throughout the country in various places. The eagerness and fervour for the elections are palpable, and we should be grateful to God for this. It is desirable that the elections, not only the elections 2 days from now, but all the elections in the country, be held with strength and enthusiasm." But why? Because after the Islamic Revolution, our young people have advanced significantly in terms of their reasoning, their research and precision. After the Islamic Revolution, the spirit of inquiry, inspection, investigation and fact-checking have increased several-fold among our youth. And this is a very good thing. It shows that young people are not only enthusiastic, passionate and energetic in different areas, but they're also rational and logical. Commenting on the importance of having strong, vibrant elections, the leader said, "I would say that strong, vibrant elections are one of the pillars of the proper administration and progress of our country. This is one of the most important means for removing obstacles to progress." Commenting further, the leader said, "This ballot box and these elections haven't been easily attained in our country. We went through a period of absolute dictatorship, and then there were sham elections before the Islamic Revolution. The elections were only in appearance, and there was no truth in them. That is, they would prepare the list in the Shah's court, and sometimes even in foreign embassies. They would give those lists, and they say that these people must become the representatives of the people. Before the revolution, we knew exactly what the electoral process and voting were like. But after the Islamic Revolution, they themselves admitted and wrote about those things in their books. People being able to go to the polls to vote with motivation, with knowledge and with faith, with expectations and with hope, hasn't been easily gained. There was much struggle to gain this in our country. Of course, this struggle started after the constitutional movement in Iran, yet the main struggle took place in the movement of our founder, the magnanimous Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, when the people stood behind the Imam and pursued this path. From the start of the struggle in 1962 until the victory of the Islamic Revolution in February of 1979, significant efforts were made in this country over the span of those 16 years. A vast amount of work was accomplished, with individuals enduring imprisonment and torture and dedicating themselves to this path. The popular movement of the people began in 1978, with Imam Khomeini leading and guiding the people to victory step by step. He taught people where they should take action, and what they needed to do, and what they should demand. He was a leader in the true sense of the word. The work of the leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, and anyone who claims this to be leader, comes from the heart and from thought and logic. It affects the hearts and minds of the people, and the Imam made an impact on people's hearts and minds. The people rose up until the Islamic Revolution was victorious. Turning to other revolutions in the world, such as the French and the Russian Revolution, where often a dictatorship follows, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Let's look at France, for example. At the end of the 18th century, the great French Revolution took place. The people there had a revolution. They took to the streets and fought. But after the revolution, a small group of people assumed power. They remained in power for 3 to 4 years before being overthrown by another group who took their place. This cycle continued for about 10 to 12 years, and then Napoleon emerged. Napoleon established a dictatorship, independent Napoleonic government. There was no talk of elections in France at that time. Worse than that was the Russian or Soviet Revolution. Now these are the two important revolutions in our recent history." Commenting further, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "In Iran, the Islamic Revolution took place on 11th of February 1979, and approximately just 50 days later, on 1st of April 1979, Imam Khomeini announced a general referendum so the people could determine the type of system of government that they wanted. And they did determine this, so he immediately brought the people to the ballot box. This is what it means to have trust in the people. This highlights the importance of having a ballot box and elections. So it did not take long for this to happen. About a year had passed after this when the elections for the Assembly of Experts for the Constitution were held. Then they voted on how the law had been passed in the Majlis, the Parliament, which was the next election. This was followed by presidential elections and the parliamentary Majlis elections. So several elections were held over the course of a year. These are among the great blessings of the Islamic Revolution." Commenting further, the leader said, "Why do we insist on people participating in the elections? We believe that elections must be vibrant and they must draw a huge turnout. But why? Because the presence of the people on the scene and the ballot box is a sign of the nation's presence in this important field. This is a great asset for the country. If we can show the world that the nation is present, is important. They've seen that when this nation is present on the scene, events like the Sacred Defense and the imposed war on Iran, the nation overcomes adversaries like Saddam, who had the support of the United States, the former Soviet Union, NATO, Arab reactionary states, and everyone. And our nation drove him out of his own country and crushed and disgraced him. They've seen this happen. The enemies of the people of Iran have witnessed the miracle of the presence of the Iranian nation on the scene, so they watch to see if people are still actively involved. When the people are present at the ballot box, they realize that the Iranian nation continues to maintain its presence on the scene." In further remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Strong elections have other positive outcomes as well. One such benefit is that with strong elections we will have strong elected officials. For example, if there is strong participation in the parliamentary Majlis elections, the upcoming Majlis or parliament will be strong. A strong Majlis can accomplish great things and take big steps for advancing the country. Similarly, vibrant, strong presidential elections with a high turnout will mean an effective government. Therefore, strong elections will result in advancement for the country." Turning to the issue of Palestine and the situation in Gaza, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The issue of Gaza is a fundamental issue in the Islamic world. The issue of Gaza, the tragedy in Gaza, has introduced Islam to the world. It has become clear that Islamic faith is the factor that creates such strength and resistance, as demonstrated by the Palestinian people and how they have stood against the aggressor. They have refused to give in or to raise their hands in surrender before the enemy. Despite all the atrocities that the Zionist regime has committed, the issue of Gaza has not only introduced Islam and Islamic faith to the world, it has also shed light on Western culture and Western civilization. Western culture and civilization is something that makes the policies resulted from this culture see these crimes, but be unwilling to admit that this is a genocide that is happening in Gaza. The inhumane policies of the United States have reached such a level of disgrace that the world sees the United States actively aiding and abetting the Zionists in their crime of genocide in Gaza. In final comments, the leader said, "We hope that Almighty God will grant complete victory to Islam, Muslims and Palestine, and especially to the people of Gaza." The leader wished God's greetings, mercy and blessings upon all present.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The dawns of the month of Ramadan should not be missed. April 30th, 2019. Dear friends, the month of Ramadan is a very good opportunity. It is a very good opportunity. It is an opportunity to do promotions, promoting Islamic values, to clarify, to get close to the people, to help the poor, and above all, to worship God, to fast, to sit at the table of divine mercy and divine banquet. This well-known banquet is your act of fasting, engaging in nafila, prayers which are not obligatory, and saying daily prayers. Of course, there are many acts and obligations in the month of Ramadan. Notice that in Iqbal by Sayyid ibn Tawus, so many acts, obligations, and various prayers have been mentioned for every night. Some of us are really negligent in this regard, as we are not aware of the significance of these acts. Of course, I do not want to expand on this now. However, there are certain minimums and obligatory requirements which should be observed. Everyone wakes up at the dawns of the month of Ramadan. The dawns should not be missed because it is a very good opportunity.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد
The world of Islam has one single prescription today and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I have said many times that if we do not benefit from the dawn then we will have no time in this noisy and overwhelming world to have solitude in order to attend to ourselves, to our hearts, and to our God. there will really be no time. We are really preoccupied. Out of the 24 hours of the day, we spend some hours sleeping, and when we are not sleeping, we have different tasks and preoccupations. Everyone has certain preoccupations and duties. Nowadays, there is no free time, contrary to the past. Of course, this is not a shortcoming of the present time. Rather, it is one of its characteristics. After all, there are various diversions and instruments today, and life has become mechanical. Today, there are some phenomena which did not exist in the past. So, there are many preoccupations. We do not have any free time during the day.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On the first day of the holy month of Ramadan in Nigeria, the Islamic movement held a rally through the streets of the capital, Abuja, in a peaceful protest against the massacre of innocent civilians in Gaza. The protest march took the demonstrators to the gate of the United States Embassy, where they sat down and submitted a letter of protest condemning the Israeli genocide in Gaza and U.S. involvement in the killing of innocent Palestinians.
America is one of the major party in this killing of innocent female and children in Gaza. Since October 7th to date, they have killed more than 31,000 innocent people, majorly female and children in Gaza.
The demonstrators blame the United States and British governments for using their influence to block a UN resolution calling for a ceasefire. They said every decent government has condemned the Israeli terror attacks on the Palestinians, but the US government has continued to support the mass murder of innocent Palestinians.
They are killing female and children. They are imposing starvation on innocent female and children. Babies have been seen under rubble, crying inside blood. We see a lot of fathers carrying a lifeless body of their children killed by Israelis. Anybody that has concern for humanity should come out today on the street and show his solidarity with Palestinians.
The demonstrators burned the U.S. and Israeli flags as they slammed Tel Aviv's regime impunity and the silence of the international community. Many Muslims in Nigeria believe that Israel's continuous killing of Palestinians in Gaza on the eve of the holy month of Ramadan is a clear proof of the regime's disrespect for Islamic sanctities. The protesters here are urging world leaders to pressure Israel to end the massacre in Gaza.